down the railroad track. It makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. Hear that lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be a guest. Old pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champaign 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board, and happy Easter to everybody. Today's date is the 28th, could that possibly be right?
I think so.
Of 2016, and March.
It's, I've been listening to Dick Cavett tape, and he was instancing a reference to Easter and the leadership that came with Christ, and so he read a little piece by Julia Ward Howe, who was a housewife with six children, but she visited Civil War troops, and they didn't have a really significant theme song, so she wrote us a theme song, and just a little piece of it is was quoted by Dick Cavett. And you have to know that at this time of the year, you often have Easter lilies, and Easter lilies are a part of the Easter celebrations. They had a nice film on at the Virginia Theater that ran through the various aspects of Easter, and so this goes with it. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea, with the glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free, while God is marching on. And so that she also wrote a battle hymn to the public, the Republic, and is well known for that. And she had to do that in the face of an era when housewives were supposed to be at home and not out there publishing. Often you had to publish under a pseudonym if you were going to do interesting things. I can remember Easter lilies because my mother had a box camera, a box brownie, and she lined up her three children in front of the Easter lilies, white Easter lilies, and took photographs. And that's become a family icon picture of us when we were young. So what else do I have here?
We might point out that the melody that Julia Ward Howe used was actually from a song about an abolitionist who was killed. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. Fits right in with the battle. For mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, the beginning of the battle hymn. The earlier verse that you gave us the spectacular last verse for. We might want to point out that the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and nobody else. Yes, I have to say, I'm not the hugest fan of things that are like hymns, but that particular song is pretty powerful, especially for civil rights and freedom in this country.
You happen to have that on your spinet?
I can probably find it for you. Where would we have a copy of that song?
We might finish up.
I'll make it my mission here. I don't talk very much. Once I get the volumes set properly on your microphone, I guess I'm free. So let me see if I can find a good, probably a men's chorus doing the battle hymn. Stay tuned.
Australia is probably more British and Irish and oriented to the church procedures that are nationwide similar. The U.S. has much more range of ethnic backgrounds and interest in religion and the like. And so Easter, it doesn't become quite so big a thing. We would have the standard Easter eggs and a few other things like that. We had go to the Royal Easter Show, which was an agricultural show in Sydney, where the farmers would bring in their prize cattle, some of them genetically prized cattle that may sell for $10,000 if you have a sheep or a cow. So the leaders in the agricultural community were there exhibiting their cattle and auctioning them, and cattle, hogs, chickens, you name it. It also included domestic creatures like cats and dogs, and a very big show which ran for best part of 2 weeks. Well before Easter, you would be there with the agricultural people, and then as Easter came along, you would have the Ferris wheels and the theme park. And you would have a huge hall filled with giant pumpkins and vegetables of great repute and cows sculpted out of butter in a freezer to keep it intact. It's just a place where people would go for a day and combine an interest in agriculture. The people who came for the agriculture and for the different circus items were often getting together themselves. There's a family of man there, and so sometimes their animals were real pets. I can remember I was working on the pig pavilion, and one of the associates that I had was a gentleman who had a very large sow that he would ride around on and scratch behind its ears. It was a very friendly soul, and people would get the opportunity to see a sow farrowing and giving birth to perhaps 10 young pigs. there was judging competitions and judging competitions for future farmers. So they would be given a set of cattle to judge, and or a pen full of hogs or a flock of sheep to sort out the genetics. The leaders of the push there were breeders that were breeding the top echelon merinos or various breeds of sheep or cattle or horses. Those breeders were accompanied by a bunch of secondary level breeders that would increase the genetic material and then add some frills to it, and they would be the main ones that were selling. And then you had the general public creatures that would come in just for their conformity and beauty. And so you would have butt up against each other people who were just the regular farmer along with the people who were breeding the background livestock that were there. And likewise, the whole circus community would be getting together. They knew each other and probably had the same site for each year. And this site was right in the center of Sydney. So it continued on till the last Tuesday yet to come was Children's Day. And just like here, you also had political days. And there were races, harness races, and always a parade of all the animals that were able to be in a parade. So it would take the whole oval, and the people would enjoy looking at these creatures as they wandered around in a line around the oval. There were probably a rambunctious one here and there. And in the middle of the oval, you would have sheepdog trials where you would have fences to be herding. You would have to herd, say, four sheep through fences, through gates, through water, and the eventual herding those sheep into a corral, and that was a competition. The lumber people would create an artificial tree with little slots in it so you could put a board in sideways and climb up high and cut a tree down from a probably about 10 feet off the ground, just because you in nature would avoid the buttress roots of a tree and get to a point where you could cut a tree. So the axe people were there. And anyway, just to give you a little flavor of Easter in Sydney. A shout out to the Tuskegee Airmen. This week the governor was here, and one of the reasons why was that the Tuskegee Airmen got its start at Chanute, just up the road at Rantoul. And that's mainly because there couldn't, a number of places wouldn't accept black airmen. And once trained, they, or at the outset, they eventually were moved to Tuskegee and then joined the European troops. And they often supported bombers that were going in, but they weren't allowed to be integrated as a group to be with the bombers. They escorted the bombers and were very successful at doing that. But when they came back, they were regular black community people and did not necessarily receive the respect that they deserved for their efforts in World War II. So we remember the Tuskegee Air people. This week we had a little fire across the road from Weft. It's the pocket prairie we have there, and we have people who enjoy that site. I would say hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people have used that site and enjoyed it, and in various dimensions. The site is a prairie forest ecosystem. The forest is basically service berries, so the roots are not so big that they lift up buildings, but there's a little battle axe shaped plot of land that's not used, and it was weedy. It used to support 2 30-foot billboards, and those billboards were deemed to be too large, and when the rules changed, the billboards were taken out. They were given 10 years to grandfather in. That means you kept the billboards around for 10 years in their existing form, and then you had to reduce the size. And that exists today. We have a little prairie in front of it with the permission of the billboard people. It's rather rare for us to have a prairie in front of a billboard, because the billboard will sell for more if it is mown. We have a mown culture, so we have to be very careful how we let the tall compass plants and docks and grasses grow so they don't invade the sign. And we have to make sure that we give the prairie its haircut each year to allow the heat and light to get into the plants. Well, somebody visited and left a cigarette butt, and it got caught in leaves, and I had salvaged 10-inch boards and the like that were leaning up against the building, and they caught on fire, and some kind person, we don't know who, reported the fire, and the fire truck came, and it was regarded as a small fire, but it could have been much more. So we have to think about having an attractive nuisance, as it's been there for 30 years, and we've surveilled it, myself and many others, just keeping track that it doesn't get to be an attractive nuisance. And people do smoke there, and to throw their cigarette butt into the leaves is not very helpful. And we still have a prairie which accumulates litter, and lightning strike would naturally burn that prairie. So if you put a cigarette butt into that, it's dangerous. So we have to think about how we transfer that small site of almost a house block size site to future generations. It requires a committee that would look after it, would burn it each year, would make sure that it wasn't used and abused, so that we have a prairie forest that you walk through into the edge timbers and into the prairie. We have a little wetland where the bath is buried, so you have plants can have wet feet, and this trail around it, and Sometimes the trail is just used by children that don't want to run around the trail until they eventually lose energy and collapse. Other times people are looking at plants that they don't see usually, like a compass plant or a dock or bee bombs. People go out there and watch the bumblebees enjoy themselves collecting pollen and nectar. So there's a wildlife in the prairie. We have cardinals that nest each year. We have our own diseases. We've just lost one of our serviceberry trees to thrips, and you don't expect that. So we had to have that identified, and it may move to the other two or three trees that we have that create the atmosphere of the prairie forest. We have to see that things like grapevines don't take over, or common goldenrod doesn't take over, so that the plants can express themselves. It's not very good prairie soil, so we have to have the more rugged prairie plants that can handle that, and we hope it might remain around. But on Wednesday of this week, it was a challenge to a fire. So now we do have to burn prairies. So we on Saturday burned the Lake Park Prairie. And been through this before, but it doesn't hurt to remind people that prairies accumulate litter. They naturally burn perhaps every 3 or 5 years, and usually were struck by lightning. That process was augmented by Native Americans that would light a fire in order to improve the prairie. They realized that the litter on top of the prairie would eventually reduce the quality of the prairie. And even if they were to burn and lose some of the natural history, that the prairie would come back from deep roots in a more interesting fashion. And besides, they could make a horseshoe and drive creatures out of the prairie and catch them for food. So lightning would strike, and it didn't necessarily strike in spring. We tend to do a burn in the spring because we like to burn before the creatures nest and get into action in the spring. And the snakes come out and so there's a sort of a unwritten law that, or it's even written that you have to have a permit, and the permit will cease so that you don't burn after a certain time in March. That's to protect the animals, but it's been pointed out from a research point of view that lightning didn't necessarily only strike in the spring or in the fall after the season is over. So you can burn in winter when there's a little bit of snow here and there, so it won't all burn, but parts of it will burn. And it doesn't hurt if not all of it burns, because not all the plants are going to be hurt by burning. Some plants don't like to be burned regularly, so if you burn every year, that's probably too much. That will augment those plants that are able to handle that sort of thing. Other plants might be like to hide under a bushel and not be burned very much. So we tend to not burn a prairie completely. We leave little patches here and there for those creatures that might like to not be burned so often. But in nature, the lightning would come at any time of the year. That means you have some variables. One of the problems was trying to grow European livestock, especially, was that the prairie comes into its own in July. That means that if you have cattle, they're not going to be available, that prairie is not going to be available for food until late in the season. The grasses, for instance, are not really there till September. You can get a picking before that. So there's a big push to bring in European grasses and clovers and plants that could be grazed. And so when we're looking at a prairie, we're often looking at plants that are growing in the spring. So right now, the brome grasses and sometimes locally bred grasses like Kentucky bluegrass are nice and green, and some of the invading trees are almost in bloom at the moment. So when you burn a prairie these days, you have to be careful not to burn too late, because those grasses burn green and they're very, very productive of smoke, whereas a fully-fledged prairie burns very clean and not with a lot of smoke. It's a rather wonderful experience. If you're burning different species, you can almost hear the different sounds. Some plants spurt a little bit of fire out one end. Some will crackle and do interesting things. When the fire's gone through, you can see where the big clump of prairie dock was, and the picture is kind of white and very different from this soft sunflower, which has a totally different experience. And if you're a photographer going through a burn after it's been through, you can get perhaps 1,000 different pictures of the prairie. All the clump grasses are there as clumps. And here and there, there will be a thread of something that was erect. Plants that are erect, like the compass plant, are not going to burn very well. So there may be a stalk of same there. Okay, so it's Saturday. I received a late night call to say tomorrow might be a good time to burn the prairie. Predicted about 11 miles per hour. We watch the wind, because you don't want to burn with a wind, and especially you don't want to burn with a swirling situation where the wind will change directions and you don't know where the front is. So that's the alert late at night. The next morning, first of all, we have to go to our warehouse and pick up flappers and rakes and spraying, water spraying devices, and get ready, always with the anticipation that the wind may be too fast. So Marcy Ridgway, who's in charge of the Savoy Prairie Association, takes out a permit with the state to burn. So she's ready to go. We wait till about 8 o'clock in the morning to see if the wind speed is okay. She has a little sort of dust that you blow into the air and you can see which way the wind is blowing. And so you want to do a back burn, so that's very helpful. In the absence of that neat little spray of material that gives wind direction, you can take your finger and wet it and put it in the air, and you can tell from which direction the wind is blowing. The next thing is to inform your neighbors. So Winfield Village, in this case, university apartments, there's a prairie retirement village there, and they're all very near to the prairie. So you have to honor their situation and the possibility that there may be someone allergic to smoke. So everyone is informed, including MedCAD, which is like 911. You usually alert the fire department at Savoy or wherever you are. Then you have to round up participants. You might be 5, 6, or 7 people ready to go. Some it's Easter, so we don't have some of our regulars, and so that's good. So by 11 o'clock we had gathered up rakes, which rakes are used to pick up a amount of litter that will catch a light. You don't want to have so much that it burns the wooden handle of the rake, but you can drag that fire. So rakes and flappers, which is a big flap of rubber on the end of a pole that allows you to deny the fire oxygen if you just leave it on top of it for a little while, or you can bang it down, bring it up shoulder high. But you don't want to do that too much, because that can actually spread fire, because the pieces that you flap down on will spread out. You need water sprayers. A little bit of fine mist spray will reduce fire very quickly. You need drinking water and perhaps some food, because we were going to be there for 7 hours burning this prairie. It's you could burn it in 5 minutes if you want, but we were interested in this prairie. It's a prairie that's a totally reconstructed prairie with a lot of native plants from the railroad bed, mixed with Johnny Appleseeded plants that we figure are part of the native prairie, as was when settlers came here. Marcy is the burn boss. You don't need 10 different people with different ideas. You need to have one person who directs the show. You also need to have a little seminar on what you can do. We may have neophytes that haven't burned before, so you have to explain what to do with a rake and litter. You can use a rake with litter on it to put a fire out. What to do with water, what to do with making a fire break. What sort of shoes did you bring? Did you bring leather shoes or plastic? You might be careful if you have sneakers, not to stand near to fire too much. So we have these things lined up. The next thing is to sort out a small plot. It might be 10 by 10, it might be 20, 30 feet, and you're going to fight the fire that to see whether you can do a successful burn. So we did that. You also have to explain to that people who come along often are very bothered that you're burning in the prairie. So you have to explain what that is, and the participants have to know that, because the visitor may encounter anyone. But that has to be explained, that this is a process that's going to help the Prairie. So I'll give a little bit of the lightning history. And then you start off, and the little plot that you use is also a way of teaching people who are new. And you teach them to put out the fire as soon as it gets towards the introduced species that are already green, because they're the ones that make some smoke. So we burned a test plot, and that was good. And the fuel matrix was there. The fuel matrix is what you burn. And if you have an artificial prairie, you may have some sites that are a little bit more weedy than others. So you will use the prairie, which catches on fire pretty well, to remove the weeds. In some places, we purposefully do a front burn so the weeds will be removed. As we burn, there's this invading small trees will be appear, so someone can come along with loppers, and you get them to cut the plant very low, because if people wander through the prairie, as they do for research purposes or otherwise, a little 6-inch lump can cause you to fall over. You trip on them, so we cut the plant low. So we're back burning very slowly on a part that is not quite as strong a prairie. It's a berm that came out of the basements of the nearby buildings. So it's rich prairie soil, but we're constantly adding seed to it so that it will have it used to be corn and soybeans soil, so it doesn't have any native plants, and we have to encourage that. Whereas otherwise, some of our prairie came from a railroad situation where there was already natural prairies. We have a little bit of remnant and a little bit of planted prairie. We want to make sure that nobody lights a fire behind someone. If you back burning, you can do a row, and then you can go and do a row behind someone. But if you do that, you have to make sure there's some way that person can escape, because the burn gets to be very hot. You have to watch that you don't get too red in the face, and actually human hair burns if you're not very careful. If you get a lick of fire too close, you also have to watch, if you've brought a camera, that the material that takes the lenses of your camera and fuses them together will melt if you get too close to the heat. You need to distribute drinking water. This gets to be hot, and you need to do that. Sometimes it's helpful to have a banana or apple or something that you can chew on, because it takes a while. We do it rather slowly, not fast. That can give people who have grown up with burns and burning drainage ditches and the like, putting a match in them and then just they leave it. Those sorts of people have a heart attack if we want to burn slowly. We just have to say, no, we're doing this slowly. We want the heat to burn the litter and let the light and heat get into the plant. The deep-rooted perennial plants are still there. They're going to come up and survive this burn. We record, so I was taking videotape and pictures, because a lot of people don't get the chance to go and see a prairie burn. It happens so rarely, and the state generally is afraid that prairies aren't being burned as often as they should be. Basically, recently, it's because of the weather. The weather just hasn't been right for burning. But also, we have a problem with Smokey the Bear. At the moment, there's a large sign on Green Street locally that has Smokey the Bear on it, and it's designed to discourage burning, but really, burning is a part of most land ecosystems. So the trails that are through the prairie are good fire breaks, so we can burn in blocks, and we have a person that mops up those little green plants that are burning that make so much smoke. So that was our yesterday effort, and you can almost see or hear or feel the prairie saying thank you. We appreciate that. We've been 6,000 years getting used to being burned, and we are adapted to burning, and we like what you've been doing. Now, come back to the pocket prairie that burned by... The prairie itself didn't burn, but the wood accumulated. I've been rather responsible for saving burnt, but we can't really burn our pocket prairie. We are in an urban setting, there was buildings on either side, so we have to give the pocket prairie a haircut, and we've been asking on the air for volunteers to help do that. Haven't had that happen yet, but it needs to happen, because you can go out there on the prairie and you can see the very litter that we're talking about and what we want to remove. And what do we do with the trimmings? We usually take them to a prairie and dump them on a prairie, because in this case the seeds are there and they may contribute to the prairie in another setting. When you burn the prairie fully, the seeds will... we often will lose seeds, but you also open seeds where they burst open, and the ground is also very black when you finish, and that actually warms the prairie in too, and it also liberates some of the fertilizer that's in that litter, and provides it for the rain will come and go down to the roots, and that's helpful. So there's various reasons why we like to burn, but we can't burn the pocket prairie. So we have to take shears and cut it, and then we take away the trimmings. And we have to also work with trees. So we have one tree there that's a very big hackberry tree, and that could lift the nearby buildings up if necessary, or if it's allowed to grow too much. So it may be that we'll have to remove that tree at one stage. It was a tree that came in by itself before we were even at that site. Well, David has been looking at the library, and did you find any?
I'll just jump in here, since you asked. Maybe you might want to close the show with this as background music. There are no lyrics to any version of the song that I could come up with. All I've come up with, in fact, is one version. It sounds really good the 1 minute that I listen to it. A Jamaican pianist named Monty Alexander has a live version of it that's done to the second line beat, as we call it in America, that you hear if you ever hear a New Orleans brass band. So if you wanted, we've only got 15 minutes to go. We could always play this.
Okay, we'll wait just a little.
And we'll use this instead of your usual banjo to finish things up if you want.
Okay.
All right.
I want to say thank you to David and Brett, who have been working with our computers. We are not a very affluent group, and some of our computers are old enough that the other day we were just sitting there and our LED went black. So these characters have got together in one way or another, and they've got a mirror. A mirror is a viewing device which is next door to your main computer, and you can see the two of them at once. So if there's two of you working on a situation, you can see both at once. Well, the basic mechanism of the computer is still alive. It just doesn't have a viewing device. So if you connect up the mirror, we still have the mirror to work with. And so it means a little jostling around and figuring out how we can do these things. And I appreciate the efforts that have gone into that. But if you're out there, think of what we do overall, which is basically to try and preserve remnant prairies, and if not remnant, we'll recreate prairies. And part of the act is to have an educational resources in environmental science as a mother company, and Heartland Pathways, which buys up all railroad beds because that's the only place where there's any prairie. And I would also say something about the fact that WEFT has been instrumental in our doing some of these things, because right now we're making a video of this program, and that will, with the aid of Banner Public Television, that goes up on Channel 6 in Urbana a couple times a week, and then it goes to YouTube. So you can get this program on YouTube. You go to the Prairie Monk, and we'll talk about these things, and you can see the photographs. So we take sometimes it takes us hours and hours to put in pictures to make this so that you understand. So we have pictures from yesterday, video and still photographs that will allow you to get an idea of what it is to make a prairie burn. And when you see a clump of grasses go up on flame, it goes high and licks of flame go up in the air. And we haven't had this ever happen, but if you have a 200-foot fire because you just didn't do it slowly, then you create your own thermals, and that can take a bundle of burning grasses up in the air. And when you get up in the air, the wind may take that bundle of burning material a long way, and it can drop down on a house and burn the house. So you can get a feeling for that when you see something. So David has been very helpful with this to put in. We haven't tried putting in video very much yet, but that's another attempt that we'll make. And we have, I think, something like 85 one-hour programs up on YouTube to do this. Just in case we don't get time to finish, let's run the music from Julia Ward Howe, and as David was explaining, she would go to Civil War areas, and she thought that the John Brown body, Eliza Mouldering in the Grave song, was not the ideal. There should be something more sophisticated. So she went home and wrote a battle hymn to the Republic, which uses the same music, I think. So let's try that, and we'll come back if we've got a few more moments later.
All right. Yes. And again, so as Dave just pointed out, the original John Brown's Body was a song about an abolitionist, someone who was opposed to slavery, who was murdered for his opposition to it. And Ms. Howe, I'm guessing, was rather religious. And so while she agreed with the spirit of doing what you can to stop slavery, she chose a more religious way of looking at it. Again, the lyric that Dave quoted earlier, talking about Christ, as Christ is what she says, to die, he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free. And so this was her religious version of the song for ending slavery. What we got here, this is a gentleman by the name of Monty Alexander. He comes from Jamaica. He's a pianist. A lot of his music is actually kind of reggae flavored. This particular track, the album is called My America. One of the vocalists that you hear on one of the tracks is Freddie Cole, Nat King Cole's brother. But there are no vocals on the particular track I'm going to play here, which is the, Monty Alexander's version of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. The beat that you're going to go hear here is far, far, far from reggae. The beat that you're going to hear has the rhythm, bump, 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 which in New Orleans and some other places in the South, it's called the second line beat. If you ever see video of a funeral of somebody in New Orleans, for example, if there's a brass band playing, after the funeral dirge part of the service, they're celebrating the person's life rather than mourning their death. This is the rhythm that you'll hear in New Orleans at the end of funerals. So here's Monty Alexander. The album is called My America. Came out in 2002 on Telarc Jazz Records, and this is his version of the American song, The Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Very modern version of
And with that, we dropped the music back down to be the background behind Dave continuing this episode. Again, that was Money Alexander doing a distinctly American song. Basically, what happened is you had American freedom fighters who wrote the song completely religion-free. Ms. Howe took it to religion, and I think it's safe to say that Monty Alexander has pulled it right back again to being just a wonderful dancing around the room if you choose to type song. And so, yes, back to the show.
Yes, and I would ask you as a musical person, what would be the music that would be in the Civil War? What sort of instruments would you have? Trumpets and probably kettle drums, and
or at least a drum. You picture people, the standard thing is someone playing a small fife, a small a miniature flute, and then there'd be somebody wearing a drum, probably not a snare drum that we would have today. You would simply go thump 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 with no resonation to it. Mm-hmm. In this song, you're hearing electric guitar. They certainly had guitars, but they were not plugged in. The electric guitar came along somewhere in the 1940s, yeah, somewhere in the 40s, I guess you could start having. And there is an organ playing here. This isn't a plugged-in organ. I'll give by him by name. It's Leroy Romans is playing the electric organ on this track. And you would have pump organs, air-pumped organs, going way back. I mean, Monteverdi and lots of folks back before Bach's time were certainly playing and writing music for the organ back then.
There's an improvisation here that probably wouldn't have been common in the Civil War.
You're right. Much during the war itself, I would think probably what you would have is you'd want the military people to stay in line with this beat. If they were, that would be wonderful to imagine these folks bopping along. The only time that you actually intentionally told your military people to not march in step, you would break stride as you crossed bridges. I think I actually learned this in high school. If you're walking across a bridge and everyone is going stomp, stomp, stomp to the beat, you build up a resonance in the bridge. You can make the bridge fall apart. And so you tell people to just kind of trot along across the bridge so that you don't all fall into the river below you.
Dance floors are the same. If you have everyone stomp at the same time, you can break the floor. I think Bill Taylor had the same happen in his barn when everyone stomped at the same time. A beam underneath broke.
A very long time ago, this album is on Telerock Records, and they released an album of marches. I remember it's actually called Macho Marches, and it's got a few American Sousa marches, but it's got quite a few marches that were written by folks in other countries, and it's really a pleasure for me to listen to, because you get used to bum 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 bum, and then you hear these, you know, Belgian, you know, Scandinavian marches maybe, and they're all so casual. You can walk in tempo to the music, but they don't have that really strict beat of the drum that we're used to in American 6/8 time marches. So yes, if you're looking for something, I mean, there's an old album. This goes back to before 1980, I'll bet. The album is called Macho Marches, for other countries' interpretations of how you get guys going in the same direction at the same time.
So can we go out with just a little bit more of that?
Sure. I can back that up, and we can finish with... I've got to say, I was not dancing around the room. It's fun to be here on Monday nights when Jess Vine is playing lots of music, and she bops all over this place. I bop in my seat, if that. Really? And go ahead. Yep.
This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. And I'm fighting valiantly to see if I can't make it skip ahead further along in the track, and it's hard to do on these players. But we'll get there to give you just a couple of seconds more of that right here, right now. And, it's now noon, and it's time for Shruti, Music of India, as we finish off with a tiny little bit more of Monty Alexander.